This episode is brought to you by Interactive Brokers. And at Interactive Brokers, you don't have to wait for the markets to open. With around-the-clock trading, you could trade over 10,000 U.S.-listed stocks and ETFs. Also, U.S. equity index futures and options, U.S. Treasury bonds, and even more. IBKR's overnight trading helps you stay ahead by allowing you to react instantly to market-moving news and economic events whenever they happen. Capture more market opportunities and trade on your timetable during local market hours or whenever it's convenient for you. Enjoy bond trading with no markups, no built-in spreads, and low transparent commissions, which can help you improve your returns. Rated a top online broker, Interactive Brokers has won awards from Barron's, Investopedia, and stockbrokers.com, and has been Benzinga's number one overall online broker for bonds 4 years in a row. The best informed investors choose Interactive Brokers. Open an Interactive Brokers account today and discover more trading opportunities around the clock. Learn more at IBKR/aroundtheclock. Member SIPC.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
Short week, low volumes, lots of action. The Fed has a change of attitude again. NVIDIA scrutiny on the rise. And our guest today, Howard Silverblatt, senior industry analyst for S&P Dow Jones Indices. All this and much more on episode number 949 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Welcome back. It's a great week. Thanksgiving this week, and we're on the home stretch here. Andrew Horowitz, I'm in the hot seat here in the studios of Horowitz & Company, downtown Fort Lauderdale, Florida. We have this great office, great studio, all things, well, great, I guess. I enjoyed my Thanksgiving, had a 15-pound smoked brisket, 3 turkey breasts that we put on the smoker as well, and enjoyed all the other fixins that come with it, a good time with the family. It was a short week, lots of interesting action, lower volumes, especially as we progressed through the week, but that is to be expected. What was most interesting is that just 1 week after that was, we had that collective sigh of concern that, a sigh of concern. All of a sudden, there's a total change. And what I'm talking about is not necessarily about the market per se right now, but what I'm talking about is what we had with regard to the Fed. We went from a 30% probability of a rate cut in December because of a lot of reasons, which we'll talk about, to a 70% and now almost an 80% likelihood probability of a Fed funds rate cut by 25 basis points in December without the data. Damn the fact that there's limited data. Who cares? And the data that we have, that we do see and have seen, sticks to relatively sticky inflation. And, you know, okay, why? Yes, Treasury Secretary Bessent, he says that it's not the tariffs, it's the service economy. It's the service economy that's causing prices to increase. Sir, whatever way you need to spin it to make yourself feel better, have at it. Because we know you also said that you're going to be removing tariffs on what? Over 200 food products to reduce costs. So which is it? At this point, who cares? Who cares? And I think that's what they really want. They want us just to ignore it and just move along like good little sheep and soldiers. The fact is that when it comes to the data, there is a whole, the reason that the Fed was holding off last week or the week, 1.5 weeks ago, was that they didn't have enough data. And because of the government shutdown, where we had limited data from both inflation issues for the next month and, more importantly, for the jobs numbers that weren't going to come out to after the Fed rate decision, people got nervous. The Fed was talking time and time again about how, you know, December's not a done deal. That's what Powell said. And then all the other Fed speakers came out and echoed that. Markets got upset. Things got tight. They had to do things like reaffirm and restate that, don't worry, we're going to start buying bonds again, and the QE engine is revved up. However, right now, markets did an about-face in the light of all the news that we saw, whether it was NVIDIA being maybe upseated by Google in the chip area, some of the earnings that we saw that were a little bit concerning, the valuation issue that has been bubbling under the surface. But again, as investors, we need to focus. We need to recognize that the important things are not necessarily the things that happen each and every moment. Every time there is a conversation about a tariff, a war, pick whatever it is, big or small, we don't have to react. I had a lot of client meetings over the last, I would say, probably the last 2 weeks. And you know what we talked about? We talked about the need to understand that what is going on now. And we talked about how we need to look at what the real goals are. Because people are generally concerned. They're upset. They're confused. So many people are confused, like, why are the markets going up or down when we have all this good news or bad news? You know, put in whatever you want. But why is it that no matter what seems to happen right now, the markets have a desire to continue moving higher? We get bad news, things sell off, and then they move back. And there's kind of an absence of anything other than a flow of money in. Because a lot of people get caught up in this day-to-day, the news, I guess it's minutia. Why? I'll tell you why. It's because that's the time frame that we all live in. We don't take a breath once a week or once a month. We're not like a whale. We actually breathe 4 times a minute. Did you know that? 21,600 breaths per day on average. That is our time frame. In and out, in and out. But that's not the proper way to look at our investing. That's not the way you want to look at things in order to make a good future for you, make a good fortune for you. That is not the outcome by looking at every single second of every single day. Unless you want to be a day trader, and that has a totally different discussion that's attached to it. 21,600 breaths per day on average. Can you imagine having to focus our time frame on that all the time when we're dealing with our future? You're not thinking about your future when you're breathing in and out. You're thinking about right then and there. Your brain is conditioned right then and there. And that is what happens a lot of times when we get caught up in. That is where many of us fall short in providing for our future selves. That is when you may say things like, is now a good time to invest? You know, the market's really high. It's very volatile. Is it a good time to invest? The fact is, truthfully, it's always a good time to invest when you think out 20 or 30 years from now. That's the way I see it. Now, is it the exact moment of the exact day, of the exact week, of the exact month that is right now? So you're 2% off on your 20-year cycle. You buy a little bit high. The truth of the matter is that you have to think about the future rather than the right now. And maybe it's not a good time, 10,000 breaths in the future, but that's not your goal. And if you think it is, and if you can't focus and do what is right for yourself now, maybe you need to do one of these complete makeovers of your understanding of what exactly you're doing, listening to this show. Are you even becoming disciplined? Yes, I'm sure you are. The guests that we've had over the years, the conversations that you and I have had. But sometimes it's tough to pull that trigger. I get it. I understand 100%. Do you know how many times that we have looked at the markets from a dollar cost averaging standpoint? We do a two-part dollar cost averaging approach for people. One is an opportunistic. So for those people that say, you know, I really can't functionally accept the fact that I need to put all my money to work right now. It's been in cash for the last 2 years. I can't do it. I don't want you to do it. What we do is we get you in slowly but surely. Right? 1 foot in, 1 foot out. We talked about that 100 times. But what we do is with that is specifically a two-part DCA, dollar cost average. And the opportunistic leads us to when markets take a hit or a sector takes a hit or an area and we believe the valuation is right, we'll push money in. But what happens if that doesn't occur for a few weeks, a few months? If we have committed to a dollar cost averaging program, we have to make sure that if the market continues to move with us and away from us, we are going to grab some of it. So what we do, we have a time-based dollar cost average that goes along with that. We have to force ourselves to get in the market. What's the point of missing 10% in the market because it was lower back here, but we thought it was too high and we didn't put our money to work. And therefore, at the end of the year, it's now 10%. We're looking for a 5% pullback to put money in. We're still 5% worse off because we didn't get in the first 5%. So we do it a tandem approach, dollar cost averaging with opportunistic and time-based. That's how you control your emotions. So let's get to it. And if you can't do this, if you functionally can't do this, don't beat yourself up. If you're sitting in cash going, oh, I missed on the last 2 months, 2 years, 20 years, you know, 40 years worth of whatever. I wish I could have had this or could have had that. If you have the sense that you can't give it up, but you can't do it either, may I suggest you give it up? If you can't do it, give it to somebody else to do it. Let someone else manage your money. Seriously, this is a great time right now during these holidays. You know how that feeling comes over you? It's Thanksgiving. Now all of a sudden the Christmas trees are going to go up. Now the lights are going to go up. It's going to be Hanukkah soon. It's going to be all the end of the year. It's going to be New Year's. It's a great time, just the way we are set up, to start to think about how we can change for the better and make ourselves better and make our future selves proud of where we are today. Right now, for those of you that are kicking yourself that 5 years ago, you didn't invest in XYZ, that I should have, could have, why didn't I? The five-year future you is still going to be even more pissed off than the of the 10-year past you. If the five-year past you, which is now, still hasn't done anything, why haven't you learned your lesson? Do something. Get off the fence. Put your big boy pants on, your big girl shoes on, and let's get going. That doesn't mean you have to be reckless and stupid and just throw it all out there. What it does mean is that you have to be in the game to win. If you're not in the game, you're never going to win. You're never going to lose either, by the way, unless there's something that behind the scenes is going to eat at your potential. And what is that when it comes to investing? What does that come to when it comes to money? The difference is that if you're in a game and not playing, you can't lose, you can't get hurt. In the investing game, if you're not in it, you can't win, but you could still lose. And you could still lose because you have something. What is it? Inflation. Inflation eats at your money day in and day out. It's kind of like constant. And what happens is, sometime in the future, your money's worth a lot less and you're losing the game. So make sure you're playing the right game. Make sure you're in it. You don't have to be, you know, crazy about it, but you at least have to give yourself a shot. And by sitting on the sideline, it's not going to do anything for you. That's my words of today. And I hope you really, you know, take it to heart that I want you to win. I want you to succeed. I want you to be disciplined. I want you to learn. I want you to do what you got to do and give you that motivation to do so, especially for those that have been sitting on the sidelines for a long time. And again, I'm going to state this point again. If you can't do it, let someone else do it for you. Good time to do it. All right, let's get into our discussion of our guest, because our guest today is Howard Silverblatt. He's a senior industry analyst, index investment strategy expert for S&P Dow Jones Indices. In addition to the general market research and commentary, he's responsible. He is the guy that's responsible for the statistical analysis of the S&P Dow Jones Industrials family of U.S. indices, including the world's most followed stock market, the S&P 500. He's been with Standard & Poor's for, get this, since 1977. He's held various analytic, business development, and product positions. He joined S&P Indices in 83 as an editor and has since received numerous corporate and industry awards, most notably for his work in the area of creation and development of Standard & Poor's core earnings and global industry classification systems. So, good stuff. Let's get right to it and bring him right on the show. Howard Silverblatt, how are you? It's been a while.
It has been, and it's been a lot to talk about since then.
So much. I want to start, we're going to dive right in, because you sent me a spreadsheet, like you always do, you know, about what's going on with a variety of things with the various indices and their constituents and, you know, the underlying, the totality of it, all that. So one thing that I found very interesting right off the bat, so I'm going to start right with the first page that I looked at, and I kind of did some calculations, was the tax rate trend. You know, we all know that there was a change in tax rates with President Trump the last time around, right? But that really stuck out, because this is what I got. The average in 2000, the year 2000, was about 35% for S&P 500 companies. In 2015, it was 24%. And the latest is 19%. That's pretty amazing.
It is, but and it's going to get lower at that point. Just a couple of numbers just so we can know. If we look back beforehand, it was about a 32-33% before the Reduction Act from Trump 1.0. Now we're dealing 18-19%. The last quarter, full quarter, Q2 was 18.65, as compared to, if you go back, Q2 2000, okay, it was 33.7. So that tax rate has considerably gone down over time, and that money has added to the companies. Remember, a dollar saved in taxes is $8-$10 in sales if you have a decent margin. Mm-hmm. More if you don't. What's happening now, and happened for the third quarter, which we don't have a final on yet, but the numbers that we do have show it. First of all, the taxes paid by the companies for their third quarter have significantly declined.
Really?
Most of this is from the One Big Beautiful Bill Act, which gave $190 billion in tax credits and write-offs, depreciation schedules, amortizations. So it's a write-off that you're getting, as well as credits. So that $190 billion was saved for 2025. They did part of it in Q3, and we claim that they'll do part in Q4. So that is increasing third quarter earnings significantly. I mean, well beyond anybody's projection. Okay, and there's other reasons why the earnings are high, but that's a major one. And since they've got all these tax credits, the tax rate's going down. So you may be looking at a 17% number, effective rate going across. Some companies already have to worry about that 15% minimum rule. Imagine the difficulty in that compared to when you were paying in the 30s, decades ago. So again, the tax rates have gone down. I do stick them on that EPS file, put up weekly, and that has going back current rates. So only shows Q2. Q3 will go after the quarter in January, but that 18.65 rate, 18.65% is coming down.
So
okay, we've already seen it.
What you said, the third quarter numbers are going to start showing this One Big Beautiful Bill Act, the OBA.
Oh, yeah.
So, but is that going to be a one time?
No. Well, you'll get more in the third quarter because you can do some catch-up depreciation and credit, but it goes not just Q4, but into next year. It also incentivizes and permits companies to buy some short-term capital expenditure equipment. We're not talking about the AI trade now, but regular rank and files of companies. So they're doing it, and they can write it off a lot quicker. So their cash flow is better.
Did they increase the 165 deduction? You know, the where you can just write it off in one shot.
Yes, the amortization, depreciation, healthcare of purchase, research and development. Okay, equipment can now be written off a lot quicker. Okay, on there, some of it literally within the year. It depends on what you have. There's a lot of paperwork there. So I'm saying short term, the government's underwriting you.
Yeah, okay? Clearly.
And again, Q3 was catch-up because it was retroactive to the year. So you got the biggest hit in Q3. You're going to feel it in Q4. But depending upon what you wanted to, the verbiage to be, you could say, well, Q4 is going to be less than Q3, but a heck of a lot lighter than any other quarter previous to that.
Which explains why there's the constant under undertone, or maybe the overtone, I don't know, of just bullish buying under any circumstance, because the realization is that there is this. Now, whether you, some people say, well, that's artificial. It's not artificial. The bottom line is this. You know, if you make, if you have gross sales of $1 million and you have $1 million of expenses, you have no profits. That's a problem for a company, of course. You have $1 million of sales and all of a sudden there's something that goes on with the books and records and how there is this, you want to call it artificial something or other, and now you have $500,000 of net profit, that drops right down and that's good for everybody.
It is good for investors. Obviously, government gets a little bit less money, but they're hoping to make it up as companies do better and there's more sales. But you're exactly right on there. And it's not just a short-term situation. What we're seeing right now with the tax credits are corporations. You and I as individuals, okay, we'll get it starting February, March, and April. That's when the tax cuts hit for the individuals. Mm-hmm. The withholding schedule is not changed for 2025. So when you go and file, you know, in general for 2025 taxes, your refund starting in February is about $150 billion for individuals.
I'll take $150
billion. It was the year before. So we got,
That's not going to help the highest earners, are they?
No, it's not. But it's going to help the majority of people. It's $150 billion stimulus going in there, which people typically spend. They do not reduce their debt. They do not put it in the savings. They usually spend that money. Higher-end people, if they're getting something, or what we call middle class, you know, upper middle class, they'll use it for their Q1 estimate or something. But still, they have more cash. So this money is expected to stimulate the economy, the same way that $190 billion, again, same bill, from the same bill, stimulated for Q3 and Q4. For that reason, plus Fed reducing the end of QT, quantitative tightening that starts December 1, which is the equivalent of another quarter point cut. For those reasons, we're getting a lot of stimulus coming into the market between now and the first half of next year. That has a lot of people buying, saying, even if we have headwinds, such as tariff or Supreme Court decision, whatever might come in there, all this stimulus is going to help sales and the economy. And that's adding to a lot of the buying in the market.
Right.
You follow the money. And if there's a stimulated economy, there's a stimulated market, I'm in it. I may not be in long term, but I'm in it for short term.
You know, it's interesting. The One Big Beautiful Bill Act, one of the things that was talked about during this was, back in the Biden days, it was like, the Inflation Reduction Act, which we know was a terrible name on that, because it was spending. Every time a bill is done by the Congress, there is spending. Everybody should really, I think, recognize that. I don't recall a bill, maybe back when, but any bill that has come through and that is, is always stimulative. There's always money coming through. And that's why when these things pass, you know, people get very excited. We're talking about just between the corporate numbers of $190 billion of tax credits and the $150 billion of credits coming down. We're talking about, you know, close to $350 billion worth of, just right there, by the way, of credit. We're not talking about the stuff that's given to the farmers, they're given to this. We're not talking about any of that. It's pretty amazing. Well,
it is an enormous amount. And again, that stimulus, you know, slides down and investors are going into the market. In addition to that, we've got sales. Sales were most analysts, I mean, I looked back to the third quarter. Second quarter, most analysts missed sales. They underestimated. Third quarter, everybody missed it. Third quarter sales are enormous. They are a record. People are spending, whether the demographics is higher end, upper middle class, however you want to do it, okay? Third quarter sales were fantastic. Okay, that helped the earnings, that helped the margins, and they're expected to increase. Again, if people are spending, the economy is stimulated, the market is going to react. At some point, though, you're looking beyond that and saying, beyond 6 months, 9 months, what about the second half of 2026? Mm-hmm. Okay, when the bill supposedly comes out, you know, for those things, when it starts reversing, you don't have the stimulus, but you have the cost factors coming in there. Yep. That's the concern, and that's when you'll see either policy and monetary and fiscal having to change, or you're going to see the market have to change.
It's going to be interesting. I want to dig down into something that I plucked out of your data. In particular, I want to talk about the comparison of sales and operating earnings. We're going to do that in a second. I'm going to take a quick break. We'll be right back. Let's talk about Interactive Brokers, because they have key competitive advantages for sophisticated investors like you. IBKR's margin loan rates are from just 4.37% to 5.37%. In fact, IBKR was rated one of the lowest margin fees by stockbrokers.com. Compare IBKR clients' low margin borrowing cost to other brokers like Schwab, E-Trade, Fidelity, and Vanguard, who charge hundreds of basis points above IBKR's low rates. The best informed investors choose Interactive Brokers. Margin is only for experienced investors with high risk tolerance. You may lose more than your initial investment. Interactive Brokers is a member of SIPC. Rates are subject to change. Get started today at ibkr.com/compare. So Howard Silverblatt, I said I want to talk about this something I pulled out of your very well done spreadsheet that you do, because you're the keeper of the numbers since forever. It was S&P and now it's S&P Dow Jones and all that. Since 2021, for the S&P 500, I looked at this and I said, well, let me look at the sales. Sales have increased by your numbers, 15%, raw numbers. From 2021 to now, the gross sales for the S&P 500 constituents is up 15%. But operating earnings have increased 27%. And as reported, earnings per share have increased 33%. Again, raw numbers, right? I'm not doing the compounding. I'm just doing the right. From then to then. Is that efficiency or is that lower share count?
Okay. It's not as much lower share count, because within the index, we go back and adjust. Adding up, when we say it's 30-something% higher, that's in actual aggregate, billions of dollars, right? How much it is, not per share. You can theoretically take your shares down to one. So whatever your sales, your net is, that's your EPS.
Yeah.
So the actual dollars, some of that is productivity, not as much as is hoped to be going forward. There's a lot of productivity increase via AI built in going forward, but going backwards, again, up to the third quarter, there are some efficiencies, there is lower taxes, better margins, especially post-COVID. People are just spending it. Companies have, remember in the third quarter numbers here, second and third quarter, even though it's a record amount, companies still absorb part of that tariff price.
Right, right.
Countries did, government did, but individuals got passed on, not full amounts, but some of it. Yet we've got that $72 number for earnings for the S&P 500 right now, we're looking at 72.31
for the quarter.
That's right. And the previous high was $64. think it's, that's a company.
But what I'm saying is, you, if you have sales increasing only by, not only, but 15% since 2021, operating earnings increasing 27%, that right. is huge. That is enormous. That's a 13% difference, right?
It's additional efficiencies on there. It's automation. Okay, even before AI, and now you're seeing some of the AI come in. And again, it's not thinking, but it's a better system that can pick out a better algorithm that they, on the production scale, on the line, you can increase efficiency right. so much more. We're seeing it in different industries.
It really is remarkable if you think about this. I think it's a very simplistic look that I'm putting on here. You know, and again, looking at the both operating earnings and as reported, but those numbers, even if they're a little bit off in terms of the totality versus one versus earnings per share on the other, it's still pretty amazing and respectable that in the totality of this, and some of that's also because you get better margins on some of the big companies, right? The big tech companies have better margins than, let's say, restaurants, as an example, right?
Yeah.
But so they're making a lot more money. So that's kind of feeding through. But still, in totality, where the investment is the S&P 500 right there. But you also talk about, and you calculated that about, I think you estimated 4% tailwind for EPS, earnings per share, due to diluted share count, right? In other words, the continuation of these buybacks that are giving a push.
Yeah. Two components there. First, on the index level, there's no impact from the EPS because we adjust for that. Mm-hmm. We back into billions. But on an individual issue, pointing, AT&T, IBM, Apple, okay, you look at these issues and about 16% of the companies, okay, just for the third quarter alone, decreased their shares by at least 4%. That means they increased their EPS by 4%. They made the same $1 million, but instead of dividing by 1 million shares, they divided by 960,000. So the EPS go from $1 to $1.04. Mm-hmm. They made the same amount of money in their pocket, but they reduced their share count by, and therefore theoretically you have increased your ownership of the company, obviously. But yeah, 16% of the companies, that's a lot. And you need to know in your company, because you do not want to pay the same multiple for share count reduction as you do for higher efficiencies or higher sales.
But I think most of the market is unless you're sophisticated, you know, people are just looking at the number, right? The growth of that. I agree with you, and obviously the institutions will pick that up. But I think most people are like, oh, they beat, and share count doesn't come into the play. They don't care.
That's correct. And the market, to some degree, you know, goes into what the company's doing. Remember that buybacks themselves support stock. It's going into the market. It's doing a bid, even if your stock is not good, okay, is more buying. You have three people bidding on your house instead of two. You're getting more money. It's not changing your house, but you're getting more money. So buybacks, when you announce them, it used to be like when we used to have a stock split.
Oh, God.
You know, it just goes up.
Interesting because that broke. That was, for a little while, that was really important. But that broke with the, I think at least, with the Netflix buyback that happened this year.
And Netflix split, by the way.
Yeah, I'm saying the 10-for-1 split. Yeah. Everybody's like, ho-hum. You know, for a minute it was doing well, but you know, it wasn't like some of these other ones that went berserk and crazy. Just to go back into the expense discussion and some of the things that are happening with regard to the ability to expense some things. There was earlier this week, there was a... Well, there's been a bit of a kerfuffle with Michael Burry and all that with this whole NVIDIA, the chips. NVIDIA came out earlier this week. They said, we are not aware of any claims that NVIDIA has improperly capitalized operating expenses. Several commentators allege that customers have overstated earnings by extending GPU depreciation schedules beyond economic useful life. That's not something you probably get into because you're just looking at the numbers, but there is sometimes... especially in the world right now with the amount of money, CapEx is CapEx at a historic high?
Yes.
It's got to be, right? It's got to be.
We do not have a final on that yet, but we've already, of the companies we know, which is about 93%, they've already set a new record.
Yeah, absurd amounts. Then we get into the issue about vendor financing, circular financing that I've been like...
That's a major issue.
I've been a lunatic about, by the way. I've been like...
That's good. You're getting ahead of the curve.
It's funny because I'll tell you something, Howard. We go back a long time, but there was a time back in 2000... I don't know if we knew... We probably didn't know each other back in 2006 because I started the podcast in 2007. In 2006, I had this moment of clarity. I remember, I have it in my head right now. I remember exactly what happened. I was standing on a lawn of a second home I owned up in Lake Placid, Florida. And my sister, I was on the phone with her. My sister said she mortgaged her house again, you know, remortgaged it. And for like another $100,000 she took out. After she took out $100,000, I'm like, what? How is that possible? Like, they didn't have the money to pay for it. And I had this moment of clarity back then, and I became a Looney Tune, slamming the desk, getting crazy that the housing market's in big trouble, saying we're going to have a big calamity going on. I went into it, and I kind of got out of the markets. That's why I won this big tournament, this competition back then, all this. I'm starting to have a moment of clarity right now with this whole vendor financing is interesting to me. It's not the end of things, but it's bad. Circular financing is even a bigger problem. And the big boys don't seem to really care because the idea is they'll just let this go for a number of years. But you're seeing the same thing, right?
Not just on the street. There's a lot of concern about that. And remember, we're equity people. Now we have to go back into the bond side of it for the fixed parts. But all the ones that you named are ones that there's concerns about. It's great. Well, it's great. But when the bills start coming due, if you don't match that revenue, you've got a lot of pressure coming in. Remember, an interest payment is not like a stock going down. You hold on to it. It goes back up. You need to make that payment. And if you have to liquidate something or cut back somewhere else, that's what you have to do. And there's a lot of debt coming out, especially in connected to AI, that's backed by fixed incomes. And while the cash flow is there today, what happens if it's not tomorrow? Just a little twinkle on there could disrupt everything. Remember the housing with all the different tiers on the housing market, how quickly that escalated. It's geometric almost. So that's a big concern on the risk side, especially on large institutions who have to put everything through a risk model and then go to compliance, even beforehand. So there's worry about that.
So the concern I have is in the circular financing or I'll say this is vendor financing in a way. Microsoft takes $1 billion and gives it to company ABC. ABC says, hey, we're going to buy back space over the next 5 years on the Azure. You basically, essentially what you just did is you took money off your balance sheet and turned it into income, as I see it.
But if you look in the contingencies on the 10Q and 10K, they're spelling that out. So it's there, but the problem is, as you said, most people, you've seen that top line, my sales are going to go up. I've got more commitments going forward. My back orders are going to increase, all this. But again, you're partially buying that. And is the circular reasoning in there is circular financing. It's good when it's good, but you've got to...
Yeah, of course. Like I said, I always say this. It's like, you're out in the wilderness and you're a million miles away from anything. Maybe you can eat your arm for a little while for nutrition, but after a while, it's probably not going to, you're going to eat too much and that ends the whole game.
Yeah.
Real quick, because I know you're on we have a short schedule today. And I need to talk to you being at, S&P Dow Jones. The top 10 stocks in the NASDAQ 100 are 70% of the market weight. The S&P 500, about 38%, give or take. When do we start thinking that market cap weighted indices are not really diversification? And are you, as a firm, talking about that as a concern?
Okay, let me talk from an investment point first on this, as compared to a corporate position on there. First of all, the market is the one that sets it. We've thought about this decades ago. There are indices out there, S&P, other companies, private companies, public companies that you can go that invest differently and cap. So they'll go in that no issue could be more than so much percent, or most sector could be more than so much. You'll see that a lot in the dividends, you don't end up with all utilities and financials. So those alternative types of investments have been around for decades. Again, up and down the row. The big cap ones, like the S&P 500, their methodology is not to cap those. Okay. And theoretically, yes, company can go all the way up. And the top of the Mag 7, which are 35%, are historically high levels. S&P in this index did not set that 35% for the top 10. Okay. The market did by bidding them up. If all of a sudden, God help us here, 3 out of 7 go under to zero, that number falls all the way down.
Yeah.
There are other indices where it doesn't. Again, that we all have, where it says you can't have more than, let's say, and I'm picking an arbitrary number, let's say 2%. So the 8% that NVIDIA has would be cut down to 2. And NASDAQ has limited Apple historically, different points. Okay, you have the same difficulty in a price index in the Dow Jones Industrial Average, 30 companies. Okay, if you put Berkshire Hathaway, the main one, okay,
yeah,
other 29, the other 29 go down to 0 one day and Berkshire goes up 5%, the headline is the Dow is up. So again, it's methodology. I think the heart of your question, which we'll get to now, sorry about that, is this good or bad? Well, it's good on the way up. It's going to be terrible on the way down. Again, if a couple of this Mag 7 go under, those are enormous companies that are going to drag it down. But that's the weighting and methodology of that. Similarly, if you bought an index based on earnings or dividends or buybacks, all these. So again, you need to know what you're buying and see if you feel comfortable with it. And if you are in the middle of the road, you can also, you know, buy sectors. You can buy an index.
You can buy the equal weighted S&P 500. It just seems to me that the market cap in an environment like this, especially as you get bigger and bigger, it becomes a snowball that's almost impossible to stop. Clearly on the way up and down, I know that is both sides. But it seems to me that is that really, I guess the point is, and I'm not going to make any kind of headway into this at all because it's just little old me. It doesn't seem like the S&P right now, clearly not the NASDAQ, but the S&P 500 is really the benchmark that people should be more so now than ever. It's not the one that we should be benchmarking a portfolio against. It just seems illogical to benchmark it against, you know, 10 companies. Well, not 10.
Well, they have such a high, I totally understand that, but you've got to ask yourself what your benchmark is for. The S&P 500, the intent is to emulate the U.S. common market, higher end, okay? Mm-hmm. Not a certain section, but the higher end of that. If that's what you're looking to do, that's the index. And it's efficient, okay? If you're looking some technology, you can go into a technology sector, you can go into the NASDAQ, similarly a small cap, the S&P, you know, 600, the Russell, but if you're in the S&P 500 or the NASDAQ, where these companies or certain specific companies are weighted that heavy, you need to know that is what you're buying. If you do not believe in that, those companies on the short run, then you need to go to a different index, okay? Or sell short on it and cover something mm-hmm. in case they go down. Because right. Again, if the 7 go down, that index is going down. It's going to be hard for the other 65% to make up for a massive loss on the 7, just as on the equal weighted, it has not gone up as much because that's the other 493 companies, okay, haven't kept up with the Magnificent 7 as a group.
Yeah, so, no, I get it. It's a fascinating, I keep going round and round with the market cap weighted thing, and I know that this is kind of standard operating procedure for a lot of people that, hey, what's the S&P 500 done and all that? That's great. And, but I just find it to be clearly one of the reasons that the larger draws in more, that helps the index. And it just is that really representative of what most people have out there in terms of their investments? So that's something to think about, obviously. Last thing I just want to talk about is dividends. You know, dividends are, you know, we talked about this, you mentioned in a note that you sent to me that companies are kind of shy to commit due to economics, costs, labor, tariffs, things of that nature, but we're going to have record payments, right? Which makes sense. Record payments, by the way, on with share buybacks, meaning are you talking about payments to shares that are out in market, or are you talking about the totality of the payment?
I'm talking about actual shares out there that companies have paid in dividends, not the buyback yield where you figure that I've reduced my share count, but physical dividends that are in your pocket sent out each quarter. Mm-hmm. Okay. Companies this year will set a record up about 4.8% year over year. The estimate was a lot higher back in December. Companies have continued to increase mostly, you know, those that are on a regular schedule or annually, they've increased, but their increase is smaller. They're nervous about making forward commitments. You know, a buyback, which is also looked at when you do dividends, can be changed in a moment. You can literally text or tweet your trader, stop buying or increase buying. A dividend, you pay me 10 cents. I expect another 10 cents next quarter. And guess what? The quarter after that may be 11. Okay, so.
And the opposite is true, too. You have a cut in the dividend, people get panicked.
Oh, you better have a good reason. You better have a good reason for that. Well, companies are shy about this.
But are they shy, or are they saying that they want to hold back for more CapEx because they think that they need to be spending that way?
When you look at the cash flow, which also looks like it's going to be a record for third quarter, by the way, when you look at that, and the free cash flow, you know, what's available, no matter what you start taking out with or without the higher deductions, which is lower taxes, there's enough money there to do it both. The companies are concerned about increasing, not necessarily for this quarter or next quarter, but how's this going to hit me at the end of 2026? How's this going to hit me if I have to, you know, be flat on my sales as compared to a double-digit increase? You know, if you go down to a 1% increase, you know, your stock's going to get killed today, much less if you have to take a cut. So yeah. Companies are concerned about the forward commitment because it's hard to do planning when you don't know what taxes are. You don't know what tariffs are. You don't know what Congress is going to do, the president is going to do. Policy can change pretty quick. So as you start to get more of a possibility of what's going to happen, less uncertainty. Okay, even if it's bad for you, you can plan. As an executive, as a board, you can plan around anything and try to make the best of it. If there's 20 branches on that tree, I cannot make 20 plans.
Yeah, no, I got you. Great stuff. Howard Silverblatt. Yeah. Howard, thank you so much for joining us. Always a wealth of information, and I appreciate you coming aboard, and we'll do it again soon. Have a great end of year. Have a great holiday. Have a great new year, and we'll see you on the other side.
You too. Let's hope it's all positive.
Thanks. Bye. That's going to wrap it up for this episode of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Yep. What do we got coming up? Ed Easterling, Harry Dent, Andrew Wilkinson. Lots of really great things. Don't touch the dial. Don't go anywhere. Lots more for the end of the year and thereafter. So we're going to get on, continuing on the process of ensuring that we are all disciplined investors, so that once again, I need to really make sure I hit this home, that the future you, the future me, is happy with the me of today. The present me is doing everything I can to make sure the future me is financially secure, financially independent, and looking back, happy with what we did today. Thanks for joining me this week and every week. I'll see you again real soon. This podcast is intended for informational purposes only and does not constitute personalized investment advice. Investing involves risk, including the possible loss of principal, and past performance is not indicative of future results. The views and opinions expressed are those of the host and any guests and may not necessarily reflect those of Horowitz & Company, Inc., an investment advisor registered with the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission. Registration with the SEC does not imply a certain level of training or skill. Advisory services are only offered to a client or prospective clients where Horowitz & Company is properly registered or is excluded from registration requirements. Any mention of third-party companies, products, or services is provided for informational purposes only and does not constitute an endorsement. Hypothetical scenarios or forward-looking statements are for illustrative purposes and should not be viewed as guarantees. Content is intended for U.S. residents only and may not be applicable in other jurisdictions. Listeners should consult a qualified financial advisor before making any investment decisions. Please visit our website for additional information, disclosures, as well as a copy of our Form CRS. Advertisements are not related to the host or affiliates and are not considered recommendations by the host of the show or any affiliates involved.